Welcome to the Green Room Sports Turf Podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. My name's Carl. Thanks a lot for downloading this podcast, and I hope you enjoy listening along and getting an insight into what it takes to prepare a modern golf course in the United Kingdom. First up this week, we've got a conversation with James Hutchinson, who is Bigham Member Services Manager for Sustainability and Ecology. We then move on to a conversation with Phil Grice, who is Chairman of the Golf Club Managers Association. The GCMA and Bigger work closely together to improve standards across the game of golf, and as we seek to gain more respect for our members and other greenkeepers, it's important to see how Phil and club managers as a whole see things from the other side of the coin. Don't forget, Greenkeeper International is your go-to destination for all the latest news and features from the association. The magazine lands on members' doorsteps each month, and it's a valuable tool for the modern greenkeeper who wants to keep up to date with everything that's happening across the golf industry and the association itself. Blackpool raised, James Hutchinson is an R&A scholar and was previously Environmental Officer at St Andrews. Prior to that, he was Ecology Manager at Fairhaven Golf Club in Lytham, Lancashire. He's a regular contributor in Greenkeeper International, including his monthly blog on all things environmentally friendly. In his role, James works closely with the Golf Environment Organisation and other industry bodies to promote examples of good sustainability practice on golf courses among the bigger membership. He's visited over 150 courses so far in just a couple of years. You'll hear a lot from James over the coming months, and so I thought it'd be a good idea to sit down for a chat and to introduce him. James's was a new role when he came into the job, and so some of you may be unfamiliar with what he does, but it's a vital position as golf makes strides towards sustainability and environmental stewardship. Hey everybody, I'm sat here with James Hutchinson. James, what's your, you've just changed your job title, what is it?
Membership Services Manager, - Sustainability and Ecology.
Brilliant, fantastic, good man. If you haven't met James, you'll almost certainly have seen his face in Greenkeeper International, where he writes a regular monthly column on ecology in addition to a number of other features throughout the magazine. James is an R&A Gold Scholar, and am I right in saying you're one of only five in the world?
When I received it, it was five in the world, but I believe it's about 10 now, so we're, 10. We're common as muck.
Common as... What is an R&A Gold Scholar?
Are you familiar with... Well, the R&A Scholarship, the Greenkeeping Scholarship, is awarded to scholars who are studying at certain levels, at certain college, MySCO, Elmwood, etc. But I think to be a Gold Badge Scholar, you've just got to go that little bit further, i.e., promote the R&A Scholarship. This is what I did. Got myself an honours degree. So just things along those kind of lines.
Okay, all right. I think it's fair to say you're seen as a leading light in golf's drive towards environmental awareness and sustainability. The question I've got is, which came first, greenkeeping or ecology?
Greenkeeping came first for me in 1988. I started a place called Fairhaven Golf Course on the northwest coast of England there. On a YTS scheme, of all things. I did my 2 years YTS, and then...
Which, for the younger among us who don't know what that is?
Youth training scheme.
Youth training scheme.
Yeah. So I did that for 2 years, and then I was an apprentice for another 3 years and taken on full-time when I was 21, 22. I stayed there for around about 10 years, something like this, and then I worked for myself for a couple of years, and then I went back to Fairhaven as their ecology manager, where I stayed for around about 7 or 8 years, something like this. And then I headed up to St Andrews for a couple of years too.
You were telling Greenkeeping then, and you said you came back as a college manager. Where was that transition? What happened?
Well, I found that I wasn't really getting anywhere in the greenkeeping industry. I didn't make it. Some people just don't make it in the industry.
Okay.
So I couldn't get myself a first assistant position or a deputy or course manager, anything like that. So I decided to start my own business. Landscape gardening, of all things. Yeah, I quite enjoyed that, but the problem is, as you know, I'm one of life's talkers, so I ended up talking to trees and dogs and wildlife and all sorts of things, so the role came back up at Fairhaven and I went back there.
Okay, as a college manager?
Yes.
Yeah, was that something you've always had interest in, that sort of trees and plants and
very
the whole...
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. More so than the greenkeeping, I would have suspected, even in the early years. I was always more interested in how the trees interacted with the grass and why certain grasses didn't grow very well around trees and why certain grasses grew very well around trees or fungus, etc. So mm-hmm. I was more interested in, and also the wildlife and the wildflowers on the golf course. So that's how I got into it.
golf, wildlife on golf course and that sort of thing has, for many years, has been a stigma of not being one and the same. Was that the case when you got into the industry?
Yes.
Was it as little wildlife as possible on a golf course, and chemicals and that sort of thing? So you've seen that change?
Oh, yes. Seen that change in the last, well, I'd say 25 years. So in the late 80s, when I first started, 1988, quite a few golf courses, and the course that I worked at too, sprayed wall-to-wall selective herbicides. So this is your broadleaf weeds, your dandelions, daisies, etc. But the problem is they also took out the orchids and the rare flowers that were growing too. When this changed around about 5-6 years ago, you started getting these wildflowers back on golf courses. So the transition has taken a heck of a long time, but we're getting there slowly.
Yeah, that is, as you said, 20 years almost there. Mm. Is that how long it takes wildlife to recover?
Well, it depends which wildlife, but if you're talking orchids and hellebores, things like this, then I would say, yeah, certainly 15, 20 years. Yeah. And quite interestingly, heather plants or heather seeds, if you damage a heather habitat, the seeds can remain viable in the upper soil horizon for around about 50 to 60 years.
Wow.
So you could come back 50, 60 years, clear an area that you damaged initially, and the heather will come back if you manage that area correctly.
How aware are golfers of this shift that orchids are reappearing? Do they think it's an accident or?
Oh, that's a heck of a question. Do golfers think that wildlife is coming back? Well, I think, first of all, it's up to us to tell them that it's coming back because of the holistic practices we're undertaking and because of the chemical companies are now realising that past chemicals were damaging. So they're creating new chemicals that work alongside nature.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of golfers' understanding, I'm unsure on that one, Cole. Sorry about that.
Well, it's our job if they're not, isn't it?
Of course it is.
Yeah, absolutely. We're sat here and it's the middle of winter. If you're a greenkeeper, what sort of ecology and, you know, your winter maintenance program's finished, perhaps? You're not quite kicking into spring yet and that sort of thing. You're maybe looking at thinking of some ecology, some sustainability ideas. What's something simple that somebody could just get themselves going with?
Well, of course, that depends on what type of golf course you're on.
Yeah.
If you're in a woodland environment, a parkland golf course, then you can continue with your woodland management, i.e. thinning areas out to allow a little bit more sunlight to come through the canopy floor. If you're on a heathland golf course, you can undertake your heather management. I spoke a little bit about heather earlier on. And if you're on a lynx environment, then you can start to manage your wildflowers or your finer grasses. So there's always something to do. It just depends on what type of golf course you're on.
Yeah, and you mentioned trees. You're seen as, you've got a bit of a reputation around Bigger as a bit of a tree fan. And you're talking about tree management, that sort of thing. You don't have any problem with people chopping down trees? That seems to.
Well, I was called a name recently, and a presentation I did, a little old lady stuck her hand up on the front row. She says, "Do you know what you are, James?" I said, "No, what am I?" She says, "You're a dendrophile." So a dendrophile.
Right, that's nice.
It's somebody who loves trees, and on uncertain occasions, somebody who loves trees a little bit too much. But yeah, I'm a lover of trees. I think they're fantastic. I don't mind if you're managing your golf course in the slightest for the benefit of more wildlife coming through.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've had indiscriminate planting in the 60s and 70s, which was a massive problem in the golf industry, then they need managing around about now. So what I will say that if you have a fine stand of, let's say, silver birch that are reasonably poor trees or sycamores or something like this, then I'd have no issue with you removing those trees whatsoever. As long as you don't touch the ancient or the veteran trees, they're far too important for us.
Okay, and how would I identify something like that?
That depends on what type of tree you're looking at. So a silver birch would be classed as an ancient tree around about 100 to 150 years. So that's not very old at all.
Mm.
If you're talking about oaks, an ancient tree would be around about 800 to 900 years old. They can grow to 1,100 years old in the UK. But yews, for instance, they can grow to 4,000 years old.
Wow.
So once a yew reaches, let's say, I don't know, 2,500 years, then it's classed as an ancient tree. I work closely with the Ancient Tree Forum. So if I find an old or veteran tree on a golf course, I talk to those guys and we record where that said tree is.
Okay. And is it, it's a case of size? You have to identify the tree and then measure it?
Not necessarily.
No?
No, okay. Not necessarily. So, well, we'll deal with oaks. Everybody knows oak trees, English oak trees. They get to a certain size around about, I would say, 700 to 800 years old. Mm-hmm. They won't grow any bigger. They won't get any wider. They start to decay from the inside out. So they start to become smaller. So even if you do measure it at a metre up, you measure it all the way around in centimetres, it's difficult to age the tree because it's going smaller.
Are they collapsing in on itself almost? Is that?
Yeah, yeah, kind of. But the right. The great thing is, once they do start to decay, then this is now a habitat for tree-dwelling creatures, those saprophytes, saprophilic organisms, and also owls and tree creepers and things like mm-hmm. this.
Okay. I knew you'd steer us towards trees.
Yeah.
But you spend a lot of your time out on golf courses.
Yes.
Visiting bigger members. What services do you offer them?
Well, first of all, I will say that my time, of late anyway, is split into thirds. So a third of my time is actually on a golf course, talking to an individual course manager or council or committee. A third of my time is writing environmental management plans for golf courses, and a third of my time is actually travelling to and from golf courses. So one week I could be in Dorset, we could do three or four visits down there, and the following week I could be in Glasgow, Edinburgh, heading up to Aberdeen or St Andrews or somewhere like this, do three or four more course visits. So a lot of my time is travelling. But what do we offer? For instance, if you were a head greenkeeper and you contacted me and you've been a bigger member for, let's say, 3 years or more, I can come to your golf course and talk you through the benefits of wildlife on your golf course, how to improve the wildlife on your golf course, do you require a management plan, etc., all the above. We do offer environmental management plans to golf courses. There is a cost to this, and that's $750 plus VAT. So you get me for 2 days on your golf course, and it takes me around about 3 days, 4 days to write the plan. So all monies raised go back into learning development.
Fantastic. And what's in a plan? Is it sort of, it's obviously tailored to your course. Is it talking about what wildlife you have? Does it speculate as what you can get?
Or can be. Okay. Yeah, it can be. Occasionally I'll ask to survey a golf course, just a snapshot of what an individual golf course has at any given time. Mm. Generally, the best time to do this is spring round to summer, maybe into autumn. That's when all the wildflowers and the majority of the bird life are active. When we identify what they have on the golf course, we try and improve the habitat to create orchids. We spoke about orchids earlier on. Say a golf course has orchids, we look at identify areas which have orchids and we try and improve that area. If the golf course has barn owls on site, then we try and improve the golf course for barn owls. So that's how it tends to work.
Okay, so it's identifying what you've got there and then supporting them and raising that one. Working with what there already is there instead of trying to transport something into it. That's really interesting.
Exactly. Create the habitat and they will come.
Okay, fair enough. Is it possible in 2018 to manage a golf course without awareness of environmental matters?
Ooh, good question. I guess so. I'm sure it is. I'm sure quite a few golf courses and head greenkeepers are, should we say, under pressure to create a certain type of golf course that involves zero wildlife whatsoever. Quite a few golf courses still do cut wall to wall. They'll have fairways, semi-rough, and then that is it. Minimal trees on site. It's just a nice, easy golf course for a stroll around. And we do need these golf courses. We do need the golf courses that have lots and lots of different habitats too, but horses for courses, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the vision of the past, and it seems to be certainly shifting towards more and more people are coming on board with the ecology and that sort of thing, which is fantastic to see. Do you ever, in your travels, in your conversations, still come up against the councillor or the local authority person that says, we don't want to see a golf course, it's bad for the environment, and you convince them otherwise, you explain to that? Is there still, among the public, that lingering scepticism about golf courses?
Very occasionally I do come across somebody who lives, let's say, in the past. Is it fair to say that golf courses are a waste of land, a waste of water, over-fertilised, over-chemicals? But it's just not the case anymore. It's far too expensive to run those kind of golf courses for a start. And of course, the modern greenkeeper, certainly the modern head greenkeeper, they are fantastically aware of the wildlife and the sustainability that it does on golf courses, so he promotes it very well to the outside industry. But occasionally I do come across, say, a councillor, as you say, that suggests that this area is a wasted land, it should be houses, etc., and that they take a lot of talking to because they've already made up their mind. But we get there in the end. We find a happy medium.
Do you? You can actually convince them.
On occasion.
On occasion. That's interesting. And that's probably a piece for the magazine, how to persuade people.
I think. How to persuade people, yeah, that's a good one.
In terms of when you're talking about roof management and that sort of thing, you're talking about growing the roof longer, letting it go, letting the plants get there, to more eco-piles and that sort of thing. If you are going to go down this road, does it necessitate a drop in the standards of the golf course in terms of the playability?
Well, that depends who you ask. If you ask me, no, not at all. But if you ask, let's say, an awkward member, there are some, he will suggest that it isn't a nature reserve. Why are the greenkeepers stacking timber for birds to come and nest in?
They look scruffy. I mean, you can't deny that. It's rotten wood. It looks scruffy.
Of course. So. Yeah. Of course it does, yeah, but it's education, it's building that barrier, isn't it? So I'm available to come and talk to your memberships. We can have a coursework, explain why those eco piles are there, why that roof is a little bit longer than it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, you'd say it looks, I said it looks scruffy, but the birds that come to feed on the insects and the orchids that are growing in the roof management, they're not scruffy, they're absolutely
there
stunning.
You
so you're absolutely right.
The wildlife doesn't live on the tees and the greens and the fairways. Yeah, in the rough areas.
Yeah, that's interesting. You've got a wildlife camera. Do you still use that?
Yes.
Or do you lose it?
Anyway? We lost one. We bought two. We lost one. It disappeared. So it just went walkabout. But now we still use a wildlife camera. Yeah, it's out on a golf course at the moment. One thing I am finding more of are badgers on a golf course.
Okay.
Yeah, there seems to be a large rise in badgers on a golf course. And this is probably directly related to the pesticide ban. We've only got pesticides that work on greens and tees now. We can't spray the roughs. We can't spray the semis. We can't spray path edges, etc. So because of the rise in chafer grubs and leather jackets, we've got more badgers coming onto golf courses, which in my opinion isn't a good thing. I love badgers. I love all wildlife. But I believe they shouldn't be on a golf course. Leave them in the woodlands, etc.
But there's nothing you can do about it.
Nothing you can do about it. You can apply to have the badger set demolished, but all badger sets are protected by law in the UK, so it's a very difficult thing to do. I know two golf courses who went through the courts and got the badger sets demolished and moved off-site, but the problem is they still keep coming back. They'll find another set nearby, so I believe you're wasting your time.
And money, I imagine, if you're going to court.
You're going to court, yeah, to get some money.
Okay, so badgers are not our favourite. What's the best thing? Yeah, maybe it's through your camera, or maybe it's just out and about spotting it. What's the best thing you've seen?
Good question.
Don't say a big tree.
Well, I'll avoid trees. A number of things on golf courses I've seen that have got me going. And Hockley Golf Course, I was there a few years back with Glenn, the ex-course manager there, and we saw a nightjar actually in the day. So these birds are nocturnal, small bird, about the size of your hand. Very brown, mottled colour, so they're very, very difficult to see. And of course, they're nocturnal, so you can't see them anyway. But we actually saw one during the day, and we disturbed it, and it flew off, and it was one of those defining moments of my career. The second one was a place called West Lancs, just near Liverpool there. I managed to find and photograph and record a grasshopper warbler. So these birds are actually called the ventriloquist bird. So they hunker down in long grass, and they're able to turn their head and make a call, just like a grasshopper, but it actually sounds like it's over there to the right, and then you think, oh, hang on a minute, it's over there, it's behind me now. So they're very, very difficult to find, but I managed to find one and record it, so really chuffed with that one.
Yeah. Fantastic. All right, James, fantastic, brilliant.
Thank you, Carl.
If a bigger member wants to get in touch with you to discuss your services more, how should they get in contact?
Well, I think the best way, because I'm extraordinarily busy, is email. So you can get me at james.hutchinson@bigger.co.uk.
And you on Twitter?
On Twitter, yes, @ecology1bigger.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carl.
We're just going to take a break from the podcast now to tell you about the BMW PGA Championship Volunteer Support Team. With a packed summer schedule, the shift of one professional golf tournament is inevitably going to impact another. So it is that the PGA Championships shift to May this year nudged the Players' Championship into March and the BMW PGA Championship to September, away from its traditional May date. The date may have shifted, but the European Tour and Wentworth's Director of Golf Course and Estates, Kenny Mackay, have once again requested the assistance of bigger members in preparing the course for the event. Bigger members who join the volunteer support team are given the opportunity to get a hands-on experience of course preparation at a major European Tour event. The volunteers will be completely integrated into the Wentworth team, and they will undertake mowing and a range of other activities, in addition to bunker raking duties for the duration of the competition. Opportunities to get involved with the support team are flexible, and you can apply for a place by filling in the application form that is included with your Greenkeeper International magazine pack this month. Okay, so that's our quick introduction to James Hutchinson, and I hope it's given you a little bit more of an insight into his role. On to our conversation with Phil Grice, who's General Manager and Director of Royal Norwich Golf Club. It was during the opening of the club's new turf maintenance facility that you heard about in the previous episode that we actually caught up with Phil for a chat. The GCMA supports more than 1,800 club managers through a network incorporating a national head office in Bristol. Phil learnt the game at Turnberry and is hugely experienced in golf club management, following roles at Haste Hill, Kingswood, Silvermere, Sprowston Manor and Legston Wood. After a short break from the industry spent developing commercial sporting experience, Phil was appointed general manager at Royal Norwich in 2011, where he's currently leading the club towards the final stages of a historic relocation to a new venue. I asked Phil whether he thought the role of the greenkeeper was changing and how clubs should help support their teams. So I'm here today at Royal Norwich with Phil Grice, who's chairman of the GCMA.
Yeah.
Phil, it's a fantastic facility here. You obviously, you've got a real understanding here of the importance of working with your staff in terms of delivering a golf product. Would you agree
that's the case? Absolutely. As somebody who's previously been a proprietor, one of the fundamental things that you go into a members club and people start telling you it's different, this is a members club, and you need to explain to them that as a proprietor the member is absolutely the customer. You can't lose a member, so you have a duty of care to look after every single member. When you work that backwards, if you have a leaking bucket, the more members you bring in, the more customers you bring in, the more customers you actually lose. So you've got to take a step back and a step back and a step back and think, if I've got the best staff that look after the customer properly, that produce a product that they want, I'm closing all the holes in my bucket. Unfortunately in golf, members clubs don't always look at it like that. There is no real responsibility. There's a collective responsibility, and that's weaker than a statutory responsibility or a financial responsibility that maybe a proprietor has, so that you tend to look at things more with a view that you need to get it right. So for me, bringing maybe a slightly more commercial attitude to a members club and actually saying, well, look, you know, if we want to have a benchmark facility, we've got to start by feeding the guys. You know, the first thing is you wouldn't have a racehorse and after a race give it a curry and 12 pints of lager. So when our guys come in each day, we give them a meal. The days of them coming in with a Ginster's pie and a couple of Mars bars and a can of Coke for the break, that's gone.
Yeah.
We give them a meal, they get their carbs, they get their proteins, and we make sure that we fuel them properly. We try and give them, as you can see now, this has not been a short project or a small project to get it to where it's at. Some of the guys out there produce unbelievable playing surfaces out of pig sheds.
Yeah.
And they're out of sight, out of mind. And that can't be, that surely can't. You've only got to look at Formula One and how them workshops look. You know, these guys, if you want your car to run properly, you've got to give the mechanics, the guys, the tools. And the greenkeepers are the mechanics in our business. They actually, they produce the surface.
Yeah. How do you see the relationship between the club manager and the greenkeeper and the greenkeeping team developing in future? What would you like to see?
If you're a manager worth any of your salt, you've only got to look at, I'm the conductor of the orchestra. I don't actually play every instrument, and for me to think I can play the instrument better than the person, that's madness. I need my director of golf, I need my front of house, I need my chef, I need my head of estates or head greenkeeper or whatever the term is. I need them people all on exactly the same page. They need to understand what it is we're trying to do, and we all need to understand how we all work together. And it is like an orchestra. You've got to know when you come in and when you go out. And it is absolutely a team thing. It's as important. And this year with the GCMA, Peter's joined the GCMA, my director of golf's joined the GCMA. They need to understand other they have to have other management skills. But in the same vein, my director of golf has asked me if he'd go to B2Me. He mm-hmm. wants to know more about the golf course. He wants to, when the greenkeepers come in and say, today we're doing this X, Y, and Z on the course, he wants to have an understanding of that as well. So I think that's a cultural thing, that you can either keep your departments completely separate and essentially franchise them out and never let them meet, or as a manager, you can bring them together and share the stresses that you have and share the issues you have of how you bring everybody together. The days for me as a proprietor where the green staff come into the clubhouse to get a sandwich or to get something to eat with the muddy boots and catering kicked off about it, we managed to do a scenario historically where everybody did a week in everybody else's area.
Yeah.
And that led my chef and my, and this is historic, my front of house, to have a greater understanding of what it's like to be a greenkeeper.
Yeah.
And that was a dynamic change. And from then, I worked much harder to bring them all together.
It's funny you say that about the greenkeepers coming into the clubhouse for a sandwich with the muddy boots and that sort of thing. It's amazing to them that some places, they're not even allowed in the clubhouse.
Yeah. As a fundamental, you know, we were one of them historically many years ago, that in the rules of the club, that all staff were deemed as servants. And as you know, historically, as a PGA Pro, pros weren't allowed in the clubhouse. You were just a servant to the club. Yeah. My very first boss, Terry LeBrock, told a fantastic story of playing four rounds at the British Open. He was the tour pro at Walton Heath at the time. Played four rounds at the British Open. He came back to Walton Heath the next day on the Monday after playing four rounds. He was cleaning shoes for the members, and nobody acknowledged that he'd actually even played in the Open. He says, and that's the way the world was.
Wow.
And
yeah.
You can now see how, for me fundamentally, this facility is different. This room that we're sitting in is a training room.
Uh-huh.
And that is absolutely the heartbeat of this business going forward. This will be from standard operating procedures to all sorts of learning styles that will come on screen, whether it's classroom learning, it's webinars. This room will be for that, and that not just for the green staff, this will be for the whole facility, so that we can bring people over that are away from the membership, that are away from the customers, and they actually come and we will do training, whether it's influence and skills, finance training, whether it's, you know, HR training, whether it's health and safety training. We've got somewhere now that we know that we can work from. So just even having a space, like a designated lovely space,
mm-hmm.
is fundamental. And the board and the wider membership understand now. Richard Branson says some good things and some bad and some bonkers things at times, but the line that he uses, which I really love, is it's not about the customer, it's about look after your staff. If you look after your staff, they'll look after the customer. I fundamentally believe it. I think if I give my guys, and Peter the same, believes the same, we give them the best facility that we can, then they are going to have a slightly bouncier step coming into work. They're not going to look at their watches to get away. And it's about, if we show pride at every level, we show faith and pride in them, they've got, they just will. I can see it already. If you mm-hmm. if you've seen here last night, at probably 6:30. The guy started at 6 o'clock yesterday morning. At 6:30 last night, it was like that changing rooms program where they were everywhere. But you know what? Nobody was going home. I'm running around making cups of tea for everybody, yeah. Making sure everybody's all right. But the collective spirit that they've got, this is brilliant to see. It's brilliant to see.
The new qualification in golf club management qualification, we in Bigger, we've been encouraging our members to get involved with that, because we think the skills they learn are very, you know, very transferable, yeah. And that sort of thing. We've been shouting out a lot about how we think that's a good idea. Would you agree with that from the GCMA side?
Absolutely. The fact that it's modular is really good. So mm-hmm. even if you weren't doing the full qualification, you could just choose the modules that you think you want to improve on. And I think I was away with Jim at the RNA forum the last few days, and there's maybe a sea change between ourselves, the PGA, and Bigger, where we actually realise that we're quite strong together and we need to work together. And a lot of our skills, as I said, are transferable.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've got essentially three different training departments going on. And there definitely is a need for us to work together, to look at what we might be duplicating, and we don't need to duplicate, and to look progressively, and not just for maybe our own world, to look across at what is, you know, a very good general overview of greenkeeping and what you need to know, maybe in course setup for everybody within the golf club that isn't a greenkeeper, and then for the greenkeeper to understand, you know, how committees work and stuff like that, so his influence skills become better, because as I say, for too long the greenkeeper's been the guy or the girl out in the shed, where people don't really give them the sort of respect that they should. And it's, you know, I've spoke to various leaders within golf, and I have told them that they need to go to BTME and they need to go into one or two of them bars at midnight on the Monday or the Tuesday to see 300 or 400 greenkeepers. Is it Weatherspoons or Yates's that they're going to? Yeah. And there's 300 or 400 greenkeepers. Nobody's drunk. Everybody's sharing information. Everybody's talking about where they're going to go to see each other. Everybody's talking about, have you used this bit of machinery? And I've got to say, I've been blown away from it. I've been a PGA member for 30 years. We don't have that camaraderie in the PGA. We try to pull it together a little bit within the GCMA with our network and events and stuff like that, and we do on a very, very small scale, but that is, people need to go to BTME to see that knowledge pool that is coming together, and you can see them first 3 or 4 days. That's where the guys go to be refreshed, to be invigorated, and I say it's absolutely vital. It's vital.
Okay, thanks for listening to this week's episode. Don't forget, if you want to ask any questions or get in touch about anything you've heard on the podcast, you can get in touch by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. Alternatively, you can contact us on Twitter using @biggerlimited, @biggerltd. Bigger also has a Facebook discussion group, and you can find out more by heading to our website at www.bigger.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so it's automatically downloaded to your device. And if you get a chance, do take the opportunity to rate us on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding people have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. Thanks for listening. Have a fantastic Christmas, and I hope to chat soon.